Welcome to Happy Horror Time. I'm Tim Murdoch.
And I'm Matt Emmert, and we are so excited to welcome to the podcast today. She is a scream queen through and through. We fell in love with her, among being in many other films. The first time we saw her kicking zombie ass in Night of the Comet and fighting off all those creepy robots in Chopping Mall. We are so happy to welcome today the one and only Kelly Maroney. Woo!
So much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being on the podcast. Like I was telling you before, we are such big fans, so we are honored to have you on today.
Well, any show that's called Happy Horror, come on.
Exactly. We have a good time while we discuss all the creepiest and most terrifying things.
You guys are great. I love the energy. So
thank you. Thank you. Well, you know, starting just taking things back to the very beginning, I read that you're originally from Minneapolis, correct? Uh-huh. So what was it like growing up there? Did you always know that you wanted to become an actor?
I kind of did, but it was kind of a secret because you didn't walk around in Minneapolis saying, I'm going to be an actress, especially when they didn't have a theater department at my school. So, you know, it's like the sunflower syndrome that in Australia, where if you're peeking up, your head gets chopped off. So I didn't really say too much about it. And it wasn't part of my reality, my family's reality or anything like that. But I kind of knew the three things I always played when I was a little kid, because my brothers and sisters were all grown up. So my nieces and nephews were, we were like the group. They used to accidentally call me their niece instead of their sister. So anyway, my three things to play were the Virgin Mary, a movie star, or a princess. So of those three things, movie star is probably the one that's less unbelievable and impossible, although still unbelievable and impossible seemingly back in those days.
You didn't want to be the Virgin Mary?
Well, I took one of my mom's scarves and, you know, we were very Catholic. So, yeah. And then actually when I was always drawn to being an actress, I fell in love with the work of it. And I kind of forgot about the movie star part because I was really into classical theater and everything. And then I got to New York to go to conservatory school that I got into. But I was really nervous that all the other kids were theater kids. They've been doing it the whole time. And I had no bravado back in those days. I couldn't fake my way through anything. And I accidentally got a soap opera playing a torrid teen.
I need to know about this accidental thing, because again, I also read on the very trusty Wikipedia that you were cast like 2 weeks after arriving in New York.
That was 2 weeks.
That just does not happen.
Yeah. How did that happen? Please tell us about that.
Okay. So I show up with $500. to my name, and no place to live. The bus driver of my school, because they were out doing, they were on the road doing theater, right? I got to stay at his place, but he was coming back, and it was like a studio. I had a cat with me who probably got sick, and I didn't have any place to live. I applied at Olympia's, and I was too young to get the job. And so I show up at this apartment rental place. And this woman, I think, was terrified for me. She said, I might be able to get you a roommate, except for you don't have any income and you're too young, because they'll be afraid to have you there.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So I think she was really scared. But then she goes, I have a friend who's an agent. She's been telling me that a soap opera has been looking for a Midwestern Lolita for a long time. They can't find one. Why don't you go over there? Do you have any pictures? And I had like one picture of myself. She goes, just, see if she's interested in submitting you, because I was like so Midwestern. I was like right off the boat, you know? And so I met her, this little tiny closet, like office, cigarette smoke. It looked like a porno office kind of, you know, telling the two people I knew in New York, I was telling them about it. And they're like, no, it's just, don't do this. Don't go there. Because the Minnesota Strip was quite popular in the 80s, back in those days, which they kidnapped women and put them into sex slavery.
Oh, geez. They're like, okay, where's this going?
Yeah, and they're like, don't go. But she said, take this one picture, slide it under the casting person's door. We'll see what happens. I don't think she thought anything was going to happen. And long story long, I got the job.
Congratulations.
Wow.
I don't know why, because, you know, every other actress in town that was right for that part deserved it more than I did, because I didn't know the first thing about being in front of a camera or even auditioning. The only reason I think I got this job, because I was nervous as hell and everything, was the guy who I was reading with looked so tired because he'd worked that day and then he had to audition girls. And I think he really didn't want this storyline because it made him feel pervy. And for some reason, you know, they always say the way to play a scene, if you feel like nervous or anything, get out of yourself and think about the other person. Uh-huh. And nobody had ever told me that, but he looked so tired. I patted him on the cheek. Now, that was completely not what my character would do. She was a conniver and she didn't care about anybody but herself. I don't know. They hired me.
Wow.
Soaps are storylines are so crazy and bonkers. Being on Ryan's Hope, what was the craziest storyline? I mean, Lolita is a crazy storyline, but is there one particular storyline that sticks out for you?
Well, there were several. Over the writer's strike, we went nuts. And before the writer's strike, okay, my character was an actress and it was kind of like she was supposedly in Evita, you know? I'm no Patti LuPone. I can't even sing. But I had the dress and everything. And the poster was like that. So by then I'd married this guy, but I was either pretending to be pregnant or pregnant and pretending and not telling anybody. So in this case, I was pregnant and not telling anybody. See, it's confusing.
I mean, already, yeah. But it sounds like a soap opera.
Yeah.
Okay, so in this particular case, I didn't know I was knocked up yet. And so I fell off a balcony because my mother was trying to kill me. I couldn't make this up if I sat here for 5 years. And when I woke up, I was like 7 months pregnant and no one said a thing about it.
So you were like, your pregnancy was while you were in a coma, or?
I guess I just, it was like a, you know, Pillsbury Doughboy or something. And everybody acted like that was completely natural. But the actors, you know, we were all just dying laughing. We could barely keep a straight face.
I love soaps.
I was going to say, Tim is a huge soaps fan. It's so awesome. And it's funny because a lot of people we talk to on the podcast start in soap operas. And we've heard some crazy stories about storylines and things that have happened to characters.
Well, that wasn't the worst thing. That was my worst thing, sort of. But I know that there were other weird things too, but that's the one that I just thought was like the most ridiculous. But the most ridiculous thing that they did is during the writer's strike, I think they did a storyline of King Kong, and they had a character go and talk to she was like really depressed, and she went and talked to the gorillas in the zoo because there's a zoo in Central Park. Uh-huh. And pretty soon the gorilla, it was a guy in a gorilla suit and it didn't look.
Oh my gosh.
And pretty soon the gorilla fell in love with her and escaped and. Yeah.
Wow. So really plausible stories. Yeah, very relatable. Well, so moving a little bit forward, obviously in 1982, you made your feature film debut in a little known movie called Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Now, since we're a horror podcast, obviously we're going to focus on your horror hits, but I felt like we couldn't ignore this one because it's such a huge 80s film. But what was it like having your first film turn into such an iconic hit? And was it as big of a hit when it was first released, or did it kind of become more of a cult classic in the years that followed?
It gained steam. Mm-hmm. Is it? Yeah. But people did, that was when people did go to see when it was out. If they didn't get a second life on cable, it actually, people knew about it from actually going to the movies to see it. I always felt special about it. I auditioned for Stacy and I auditioned like 85 times.
Oh my gosh.
And they said, you know, I'm sure that they already had Jennifer Jason Leigh out here, but I was in New York, so I auditioned with Phoebe and Brian Backer, who played the rat. Mm-hmm. And we just read the whole thing over and over and over for all the producers and the, you know. And then I thought, I must have this part. And I didn't get it. And I was like, I can't believe I didn't, you know, I was very disappointed. But then they called back and they said, does she want to be the cheerleader? And I was like, the cheerleader? Because I'm playing an evil Lolita in the soaps. And then what people don't realize is I did another movie before Fast Times. When I was on the soap, I did a movie called Slayground with It has Peter Coyote. It's an English movie out of the UK. But they were in New York, and I sent him this audition tape. See, people think this audition tape thing is new. We've been doing this the whole time. So it was to play a psychotic killer. So I went, you know, when you're on the soap, you're so used to like playing weird stuff that's completely uninhibited at that point. So I just played the worst psycho you've ever seen. So I get the part, and I say to the director, "So is that what you'd like me to do?" And he said, "No, no, that's not what I'd like you to do." I said, "Well, how come?" You know, I was trying to figure out why I got the part. He said, "Because of what you did, I knew you could do what I want you to do."
You know, it's funny because I saw Slayground on your IMDb, but it said 83, but you filmed it before Fast Times. It just came out after Fast Times?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Wow. Because it was an
independent movie, and chances, I without knowing what happened, I'm pretty sure like they didn't sell it right away or did the festival circuit first. Mm-hmm. I believe I read later on, like recently, you know, so, that it did the festival circuit and stuff like that. So that was like a real independent movie. And then Fast Times was a Universal movie.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. I'd never been to California, and there I was at Universal Studios. So I couldn't drive. So the Teamsters would pick me up, because my choices were the Teamsters can pick you up, you can walk, you know, or take a cab, which is like way too expensive.
No Ubers yet.
That's the thing, yeah. So the Teamsters, but they had to get there at the crack of dawn. And like, even if my call time wasn't till like 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. and I would go and I would watch Universal come to life.
That's awesome.
And it was better than what, you know, it was better than like a TCM opening. It was just, you know, you see things roll in, you saw the sun coming up, you saw, you started to smell the burritos at the breakfast trailer. You saw that wardrobe coming in. You saw the little golf carts coming around, and I got to sit there and see all of it. And then I would, when my makeup people, the hair people got there, then Sean Penn would come in, because that was extensions and he had to have those sewn in. So he and I would be the only ones sitting there. And then the makeup lady would say, "You kids have to be nicer to Sean. He's such a sweet boy," because he was in character the whole time, because he wanted people to reject him.
Did he smoke weed on the set to get really in the character? I always wonder that, because he's so good as a stoner. Like,
Well, he grew up with those guys. That's why he grew up in Malibu, where, I mean, all he had to do, he knew those guys, and he just studied those guys. But he said he never smoked pot in his life, and I believe him. I do.
Wow.
I can say I never have.
I cannot say that.
Yeah.
I can't say that, but wow. Well,
I tried and I threw up. I didn't handle it very well.
I'd probably be the same.
Really?
Way.
You know, it's so funny. I can't, we're such a tangent, but because some people smoke marijuana to actually settle their stomach, but anyway,
it was
horrible.
My head, first you laugh like crazy, but then all of a sudden the room starts spinning. And you throw your guts up and you're holding the bed and it's still going round and round and you're paying for death. I went, this is not fun for me. I'm not doing this again. You're like,
No, well, anyway, so moving on to Night of the Comet. Moving on to Night of the Comet, because we have so much to ask you about this. I wanted to ask you about the audition process. And the reason is because we recently had your wonderful co-star, Katherine Mary Stewart, on Happy Horror Time. And she said that in the final round of auditions, you both actually read alongside girls that looked more like each of you, meaning not each other.
Mm-hmm. Tom Everhart had this thing where he thought that we had to look like little sisters, like on Law and Order. Now, Law and Order fascinates me because the way they cast these actors look like their family. And I always, you know, hats off to them. I don't know how they keep doing that. But so he had this idea that if we use Kathy, we have to have a brunette. And if we use Kelly, we have to have a blonde. So there was like this one blonde actress.
So Hollywood is just about hair.
So they had a blonde actress there too. And the producer walked by and he goes, "What's the matter with you? Why do you look so nervous?" And she said, "I'm the only blonde sitting here." And I went, "I'm a blonde. I'm sitting here too." But they were Wayne Crawford was an actor too. So he was very sensitive to the whole thing. I walked in and I read the script and I wanted to play Reggie, because I was tired of playing the kid, you know?
Yeah.
And she was, because of that zombie scene in the beginning. And because he was an actor, he said, "All right, I'm going to let you read that just to get it out of your system, but you're Sam."
Well, that's
okay. So let me read it. I read it and I was like, and he went, All right, that was good. You're Sam.
He's like, that's great, but you're still Sam. Well, the reason I was asking, because funny enough, Catherine told us that the Sam she read with was Heather Langenkamp, yes, who ended up, you know, being in Nightmare on Elm Street. Do you remember who the Reggie was that you read with? Like, was she someone who ended up being in stuff? Or
I don't remember her name right now, but I think they read her separately.
Oh, okay.
I never read with Kathy. I never met her until the first day when we went to have those pictures taken for the living room. Yeah. Where it's supposed to be little me, little her, and Tom Everhart was our dad, the Green Beret.
I love it.
Yes.
But I also read for Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh.
For Nancy or for
Yes.
Tina?
And I always go, you know, all of a sudden Tom's telling that story like every 5 seconds. So everyone's like, Heather Langenkamp read for Night of the Comp. Like, I also read for Nightmare on Elm Street, and she got the franchise.
Oh.
I got Bupkis.
Well, but you know what? You got
I
Sam
was dead in one independent movie, and she got a. So you know,
yeah,
I
you got
really
to shoot a
caster.
you got to shoot a ton of guns and kick zombie ass, and she just wrestled around with Freddy.
and were you a fan prior to? Did you like horror films or sci-fi? Like, did you?
Specifically, I wasn't. I didn't have that in mind. I wanted to be a movie star. I wanted to be like. I was trying to get to be as A-list as that was my ambition, like Meryl Streep. But it wasn't Meryl Streep for me. It was Betty Davis from when I was a kid.
Oh,
Betty Davis,
good choice.
Of course, yeah.
That's who I wanted to be. But looking back, when I first saw Betty Davis and her stuff, those were horror movies.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's, so people always say, did you always want to do horror? And I guess I did, but I didn't say I'm going to. That's something that people do today. They go, I want to go into horror. Mm-hmm. But back in those days, you did like a writer director would do horror to get his foot in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't necessarily because he loved horror, you know, and you know, actors the same way. As a matter of fact, you would do the movie thinking, I'm working on my craft, I'm paying my bills, and no one will ever see it.
Except
there was no such thing as the internet back then.
You're like, except, but then 30-40 years later,
boom, you thank god I didn't even know anybody was looking at this stuff, and neither did Barbara Crampton and I, and little did we know that we had no idea that this stuff was even popular.
Yeah, we grew up with it.
Yeah,
we
love it. And you know, I feel like I know the answer to this next question, but I want to ask it anyway. So your chemistry as sisters with Catherine Mary Stewart, it's just so good and believable. Like the two of you together, it just really makes the movie so enjoyable and relatable. I mean, that and obviously like the writing and the story. But what was your relationship like with her throughout filming? Were you guys close or did you become close after?
Well, it was a funny thing. It was not, there's not a lot of discussion about it. We never got together and went, let's do our backstory. We didn't do any of that stuff.
Yeah.
We were both on soaps, and Minnesota is not that different from Canada. It's right up, it's the same kind of work ethic and the same kind of do your job kind of thing. She got there, I got there, and we just started working. And I found her very reserved, like more reserved than well, I think probably everyone finds Kathy more reserved than I. But not that she's super reserved, but I'm super not reserved. It just was a subconscious thing. I've said since, you know, because I am allowed to sound like an idiot, that I think it's probably a past life thing. Because it was just wild. We just fell into that thing. And I noticed today when I see her, like we do a panel together or something, we fall into the same thing of like, she's the big sister and she's bossy. And I'm like, oh yeah, actually even an actor said to me, I said, oh yeah, I did a movie with your sister. I said, she's not my real sister.
Yeah,
she's
amazing.
Not my real sister. But I think people just like got that. You know?
Well, they did. Like I said, it's one of the things they absolutely love about the movie. It's just like when you have a chemistry that's so natural like that, it does feel like you're. It's like I want to believe that you guys are sisters in real life.
So you,
I feel like we are.
A bonding experience must be like shooting those guns. I mean, have you ever shot a gun before?
Or before filming, had you ever?
I killed somebody on the soap, somebody in Slayground, and.
Oh.
Yeah, I didn't kill anybody in Fast Times, but then I killed. Yeah, there was a guy who's, you know, they call them wranglers, like if it's a horse wrangler or a gun wrangler or, you know, whatever is on the set, they call them the wrangler. And my proudest moment was I was doing a a guest spot or something. I can't remember what it was. And the gun wrangler came and he went, oh, her? She knows. Oh. Let's get a sandwich. She knows what to do. It's like, wow, I've arrived.
That's, I mean, well, and then that's how I know there's the famous improv line, which you did when the gun stuck about the daddy would have gotten us mm-hmm. Uzis. Did that just kind of come to you then? Because you were, I know that they were, I think we had heard from Kathy that the guns were like constantly sticking and it was just tired of doing it, right?
Tom Eberhardt asked for Uzis and they said no, they couldn't afford them. And he got a whole bunch of Mach 10s. And Tom knows his guns. And he said, this is going to cost us a fortune. You saving a little bit of money is going to cost us a fortune. They're going to jam. They're going to hold us up. It's going to destroy being on time or you know, shooting outside or anything. You're going to be so sorry you did this. And he was mad about it the whole time because he was right. They did. They blew take after take. That one particular time where I'm shooting up the car, he was by that time he was like so over because he was over it to begin with. He said, all right. And then of course it jammed. He comes over to me and he goes, next time that happens, I'm not going to cut. Just say something. And I said, like what? Cause I thought I was going to get in trouble with the producers are going to think it was me. And I said, tell me what to say. And he goes, I want you to just be disgusted like you do and say, that's the problem with these things. Daddy, meaning Tom, would have gotten us Uzis and then just walk out of frame. I said, all right. And so I did.
And that's
love that scene because they could sense that it's real. You know, that really did happen. Like next time that happens, I'm not going to cut.
I love it because Tom Eberhardt was your dad in the picture. So you actually were being
kind of treated very fatherly. He was very fatherly. Yeah, and then I did another movie with him called Face Down, and he used to accidentally call me by his daughter's name.
Oh, geez, daughters, sisters. There's a lot of family relationships going on in these movies. You know, one thing that we read on IMDb, and this could be totally incorrect, but I was hoping maybe you would know if this was right, is that in an earlier draft of the Night of the Comet script, the character of Sam actually died.
Yes.
Oh, did you ever see the draft of this script? And what happened?
I never saw it. I saw the first part I saw was Teenage Comet Zombies. Can I just say once and for all, there was no mutant in there?
Everyone said, oh, yes, because it is.
That was before mutants, okay? So there was no mutants in there. I know what it says on the IMDb, but there was not any mutant word in there. I saw it myself.
Yeah.
I heard later that when Tom, his first draft was, because when he first asked for actresses, he said, I want somebody super annoying because we're going to kill her. So, you know, that cheerleader in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, like annoying like that. And Wayne goes, she's with my agency. I can actually get you that annoying cheerleader, I think.
I thought you were hilarious.
Yeah, I didn't Thank find you annoying at too. All. In that.
I did too. But then Wayne and Andy said, because they knew the secret of success with Valley Girl. You know, he said, if you kill somebody, they're going to walk out. This is before they even had, I'm not going to say because I was so great, because they thought this before I ever showed up. And they're going to walk out. That is a bummer. So Kathy and Robert were supposed to find a baby, but I was supposed to die.
That would have been awful. I mean, because
it would have been awful.
I mean, in the movie, it's scary when she gives you the shot and you think there's a chance. But I remember the first time I saw it thinking, oh, my God, if they just killed Sam, this is going to change my entire
in that dream sequence.
Yeah. Like, so thank God that they changed that. That's creepy and scary that they were even thinking of doing.
Well, Tom was leading more towards serious. He'd done a movie called Soul Survivor. Of that, and now we managed to turn it into social commentary and sarcasm in Night of the Comet. Although if you ask him, it was not social commentary, but come on, it was social commentary. I'm sorry, Tom. Right?
Yeah, definitely.
He'll say no, it wasn't, but he just likes to be contrary. So in a comedy, I mean, one of the things that defines comedy is that there's a wedding at the end. So that's why they came up with DMK. They said, we can't leave her alone at the end.
Yeah.
That's a bummer. So it just all sort of, how can we make this light and a good experience and not a bummer of an experience for the audience.
Yeah. No, it's good uplifting. And, yeah. And you have a chance with him in the car, which is cool too. And, you know, speaking
of- It's a convertible.
Yes, and it's a hot
car. Not only that, but I have no competition because my sister's with Robert and, you know, I'm the only girl on earth. Ha 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 ha.
You're like, you can have any guy that's left that you want. You know, so this is such a great movie. It's become such a cult classic. And we had heard a lot of different things about there possibly being a sequel, but apparently yeah. Tom Eberhardt wasn't interested. But then I think I heard at some point that you had bought the rights to the movie.
I did, every 3 to 5 years, somebody says, I'm going to redo Night of the Comet because it so needs to be redone, right? So the world needs a redo of Night of the Comet. And there was going to be a cartoon and, you know, Tom got disgusted with it. Tom didn't make any money. I made scale plus 10. I always thought Tom kind of took a beating on Night of the Comet. And I thought that he doesn't have the rights. I thought he should have the rights. I should have the rights. And we should, more to the point, we should own it because I was scared what would happen if some idiot got a hold of it, you know, actually, because it was often enough that they're saying, you know, I'd get an email. Out of respect, I wanted to let you know that I'm doing the remake of Night of the Comet. Well, after I get like 5 of these emails, I go, sure you are. You know? at first I thought we got to buy this thing.
Yeah.
And so I talked to Tom about it and he said, well, if any, he didn't want any part of it, but he said, I will write you a letter. I still have the letter that he wrote to MGM. And then one of my friends played poker with Madonna's attorney and at the time. And so I got to talk to him and he did this for me for nothing because please believe me, I probably couldn't have afforded 1 second of his time. And so MGM sort of had to take me seriously for the time being. And they actually, we did out the whole thing. And I thought, okay, so if I get the rights to Night of the Comet, all I have to do is pay for that. I don't know how I'm going to do that, but I'm going to figure it out. And so finally MGM called me, which blew my mind. And they said, well, we've decided that we're going to develop this ourselves.
Oh.
And I told Barbara, and I said, this is what happened with it. And she said, well, that's better than what I got. I wanted to buy Castle Freak, and they hung up on me. See, they're wise to it now. They know if an actor comes at nosing around about an old movie, that there must be something to it.
Has people like us following it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Does that mean so they still own the rights then, so they can do whatever they want with it if they want to do a remake, if they want to do whatever?
Well, here's what happened. They finally, because everybody, it was so unfair. There is now a rule that I think it's after 35 years or something. Although the writer director had signed away his rights to it, because we didn't really know what we were doing. They changed all the laws so much that's why all these movies are in limbo, because somebody'd own the music and somebody'd own the rights to show it in a theater. And another person would own the rights to show it on cable. And it was just, you couldn't. So MGM had the money and the patience to get all of the rights. And so they put the DVD out. And I think that they had no idea that it was going to be, it was really up there in the charts. I think it flabbergasted them. So, so they had to make a rule that after a certain amount of time, and I think it's 35 years, the writer director can have 10% of the rights to their movie back. Which is big of them, right? Yeah.
But wow, that whole 10%.
It's enough so that you know that they do have something, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so throughout the years we've been people always say, okay, I have this great idea for Night of the Comet. And you go, okay, I get to hear this about Shopping Mall too. It's like, you know, I have nothing, I have no power, you've wasted your breath. I just want to tell you what it is. Okay. I've heard a couple of really, really good ones too. Really good ones. So Omega, which is a boutique division of MGM, had it. And they were, you know, they did the same thing. We're going to do another treatment of it or, you know, it's Remake City. And I get, you know, I'm tired of remakes myself personally, but I mean, you know, what do you call it? If they only do one production of it, of Hamlet, you know, and everybody remakes, you know, so there's that, but I'd be more excited about a sequel, but I don't think, see, that was a time capsule of the 80s. And also when it has gone around to all the studios, they've all come to the same thing. It's been turned down so many times is because it's a story about the sisters. It's not a story about
the zombie. You know,
the end of the world.
They got special effects. They put a red lens on the camera. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do? You know, like make it really fancy and spend a lot of money. And I don't think that they make movies about sisters anymore. Nobody's going to, oh, that's going to make a fortune right there. You know,
but how about sisters and their daughters with a new generation? You guys are fighting the zombies together.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, there's maybe I still think, I still don't know that a studio is going to, but we'll see.
So what was it like returning to the Sherman Oaks Mall?
You know, okay. When I did Fast Times, I was at the Santa Monica Mall.
Yeah.
So I had never actually been to the Sherman Oaks Mall.
Oh, what? But then because, the Night of the Comet scene was at Sherman Oaks, right?
No, it was, what was it?
Well, we know that the exterior was the Beverly Center for Chopping Mall.
Yeah,
yes. And then we couldn't do it. There was something about the elevators and the robots and something or another was not working. So we ended up at the Galleria. And fortunately, the reason there's so many movies shot in the Galleria is the guy who owns it was a movie buff. And he made it so easy for us to come, everybody to come in that wanted to shoot there because he loved it, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, my mall's in another movie, you know? So every time he came down, there's the Galleria. He made himself even more famous than he already was.
I know it's a great mall. And I feel like it was used in a ton of movies.
Yeah.
It was.
In the 90s. And so
I love stuff like that. Yeah. I think it's so, I love to live here for that reason.
Me too. I'm so in love with Hollywood. Just like my first day here.
Yeah.
You know, same. I've lived here all my life. I love all the old stuff. And I'm still in love with Hollywood. I never got that, oh, I hate it here thing that some people get.
Right.
So, you know, speaking of other big names in horror, and you actually mentioned her, Barbara Crampton, obviously, mm-hmm. was starring alongside you in Chopping Mall. What was she like to work with? And are you both still in touch? It sounds like
we are. Yeah. She was, I'm really lucky because almost everything I've done, I came away with a friend for life. Mm-hmm. And Barbara, yeah. And I treasure that friendship. And we just got to be friends right away. And then she got married and everything. And I didn't, you know, you never hear from your friends when their kids are little, same with Kathy, but then when their kids grow up and they come back and they do their thing again, then they show back up in your life. And it's been really fun for me because they're back, you know?
That's awesome.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And you know, it's great. And like to stay in touch and even to see people at conventions and things. And, you know, another thing about Chopping Mall, we read that you did all your own stunts in Chopping Mall. Is that correct?
Jim Wynorski he said, I'm not going to ask her to do anything that I wouldn't do. So yeah, all the spiders and the snakes and everything, they dropped a scorpion on him and he said, no scorpion. That was me hanging there, but they wouldn't let me do the fall. And the reason they wouldn't let me do the fall was Jim was doing his own thing and he broke a rib.
Oh my gosh. Oh.
So and I didn't really know this. Because I don't think he didn't want everyone to be scared or to slow anything down. But I doubt there's any insurance on me. So if I got hurt, that would have been a very bad thing. So somebody else did the fall for me. And then when the paint store blew up, that was not me standing there.
Okay.
It's an amazing scene. I love that scene.
Yeah, but so you were saying, but the spiders and the snake, those are all real? Those the ones?
Oh, yeah.
You can tell.
I mean, like, I guess some of them, and they looked real, but it's like, was that terrifying or are you cool with like insects?
It just so happened, lucky for me, I wasn't scared of them. And also the bug wrangler, he was really smart about the way he did it. And of course, that's his thing. He brings scary things onto a set. So he knew what to do. I'm sure he was practiced at this, but he said, this is Dolores. She's worked with all the greats. She's a real pro. You're in good hands with the spider, right? So he normalized it for me so much that even though I was a little bit afraid it was going to get caught in my hair because I had that 80s hairdo, I was a little bit afraid of that. And, you know, I was really happy when it was over, but I wasn't terrified or anything. I had to act being terrified.
So when the movie's released, it like, because was there like a red carpet premiere for Chopping Mall or
no.
any kind of screening?
Was there any cast and crew screening or like, how did you see it for the first time on the big screen?
And did you get to hang out with the handsome Russell Todd and Tony Odell?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're still friends. I mean, I just saw Russell. We did there was a drive-in thing during the pandemic when, so we didn't get close to anybody. But he came out there and we did a Q&A before the movie. He's lovely. And so is Tony. He's lovely, too. They both are just as good looking as they were at the time.
I like that.
They are both studs. Yeah. I mean, it's a very good looking cast. All of you would just like, so everybody was like young model like looking cast.
Not me. I kind of always looked like a regular person, I think.
Oh, no, cutie patootie.
That is not true. And for everyone listening, Kelly looks incredible.
Yeah, because it's a podcast, so you can't see, but
we can see. Looks incredible.
Yeah,
please. So, yeah. So when? How was the first time that you saw it on the big screen?
I think that there was a screening where we all just went so we could see it, because I remember just us sitting in the theater, and then they opened it in New York, and they had outside the theater. They had a loop going of Susie Slater's head exploding over.
Hilarious. But originally it came out as Killbots, right?
Yes, but it didn't sell. I guess it wasn't good marketing. It's like, what's a Killbot? Who cares what a Killbot is, right? Mm-hmm. So Chopping. Now the legend is, I don't know if this is true or not, that a janitor just goes, they're going, what do we call it? And a janitor said, I don't know, why'd you call it Chopping Mall? I don't know, but it's a good story. Either way, something like that probably happened. And so the first thing everybody says to me is, nobody gets chopped. And I go, yeah.
You're like,
that's true. Nobody gets chopped.
So was there talk of a sequel? Chopping Mall 2?
Yeah, was there ever?
No, it's been talked about. Occasionally somebody wants to redo it.
Are you up for the reboot?
Are you up for, or would you be up for a sequel?
there's a really good idea that's been, that Jim presented that I hope gets done, but I can't say that for sure that it's going to, but some of the music was updated.
I love the music. Do you care for it?
Music makes it.
I love it.
It's just like Star Wars. The music makes it, you know, yeah. You don't want to watch those big marches without that music.
Just the opening. I love the opening of the movie.
And horror, especially. Like, how many horror movies wouldn't be what they are today without their music, their score?
Yeah, to this day, that music is occasionally in my head.
Me too.
So then, all in all, between the character of kind of the more flirty, fun Samantha Belmont and the slightly more reserved but just as tough Allison Parks, which character did you feel like you identified more with of those two?
I was thinking of a younger member of my family when I played Sam because of the older sister. But actually, I was the youngest. My brothers and sisters were grown up when I was born. So,
okay.
That was normal, but with my nieces and nephews that we were contemporaries, I felt like the older person, but I wasn't really. It's just that I was the aunt, you know. I was the aunt to older people than I. I was like, you know, and they got like my nephew would be like 20 years old. And he's like, this is my Aunt Kelly. I hated it so bad. I hated it so bad because I was little and. So Samantha, that was me. That was just me pouring my heart out. Uh-huh. And then for Allison, I was trying to grow up a little bit. I was really scared that I was going to play a child forever. And I just wanted her to be really smart. But you always end up, you don't create a character as much as you pull the parts out of you that are that character. Mm-hmm. So she became more serious because I had the real sense of other people. Other people's lives were in danger besides mine. Mm-hmm. So it sort of took on like a, I have to do something to save these people too. And I think it made me more serious, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Definitely. you know, so you've done a slew of other horror and sci-fi films throughout your illustrious career. And we just wanted to touch on a couple others really quickly, because I know we're coming to the end here. But I think the Zero Boys came out right around the same time as Chopping Mall, right? Or did you do
that? We shot it before.
Oh, you shot it before. Okay. You know, and one of the most memorable parts of that movie, I think, when you're hanging upside down in the trap that's set by the killer, were you actually hanging upside down in that scene? And what was that like?
Well, we had stunt people for the fact that they had to hang for such a long time that we would have, our brains would have exploded. So it's a very quick shot, as you can see, because they're like, these actors are going to faint.
And you were filming up in where they filmed Friday 13th Part 3. I mean, was that a big thing? I mean, because as a horror movie fan, I was like, oh, I got so excited to see it.
Yeah, and talk about another connection to Dana Kimmel.
So that's why one of the characters says, Jason, are you home?
Yeah. You know that place is burnt down. It no longer exists. Oh. But the barn is still there.
It was called Kelly Ranch, and it was really far away.
Yeah, it's like Santa Clarita, right?
Mm-hmm, it's really...
I love that Kelly Ranch.
I know. Why? With a why.
Yeah.
That was, like, talk about low budget. We all had one trailer, and you'd have to guard people while they were getting dressed and stuff. Oh, boy. Wow. And so I was coming off that. As a matter of fact, when Orski called my agent and invited me in to meet with us for a Chopping Mall, I came from shooting all night long to my meeting. Pretty much. I think I actually did. And so I was tired. I was exhausted and I was very relaxed. I didn't know what I was meeting him for. He seemed like a nice guy, whatever. And then, so as I started to audition for the Cormans and stuff like that, it sort of came home to me. This is a lead. It's a Corman movie. And they're very East Coast kind of upper classy. So they're, again, the word reserved, you know? And so I started to get nervous and he pulls me and he goes, what's the matter with you? I said, I'm nervous. And he goes, be like you were when I met you. I said, well, I was tired. And I didn't know what you were inviting me over for. So at the Corman facilities, you know? So that was another reason too, is Julie had Dana Kimmel on her mind. So I almost didn't get that part. But he kept calling me going, okay, he didn't tell me that somebody else was going to get it, but he kept checking in with me to make sure. Because if he went to the mat for that casting and then I went, you know what, it's not enough money, I'm not doing it or something, he would have probably killed me. Right after they killed him. Yeah. So,
well, you know, moving way ahead in your career, mm-hmm. you did in 2018 the horror film Hell's Kitty with a ton of other big mm-hmm. names in horror, like Adrienne Barbeau, Michael Berryman from The Hills Have Eyes,
Courtney Gaines,
Children of the Corn. Mm-hmm. How did you get involved in that project? What was it like working alongside so many horror icons like yourself?
Okay, so they gave my manager a call at the time. My manager at the time, and they said this is a it's for charity. It's for cat spaying and neutering for that charity.
Oh my gosh.
And so I did it for free because it was charity, because it was not union. But you can do not union if it's for charity. And then I found then it was a web series. And so that's what we thought we were doing. But then he pieced it together and made a movie out of it. And everybody was really mad at him because Doug Jones was up for an Academy Award that year. And he's like, you know, but Doug Jones is like the nicest, sweetest person on earth. He didn't say anything bad about it, but you know, he was kind of not happy. And
so it was kind of a switcheroo. They're like, web series? No, it's a full blown movie.
Yeah. And there was really nothing much anybody could do about it, but he made it into a musical.
Well, I saw that Dale Midcalf was dancing in drag. I thought that was very interesting because I was like, who is that? Because I know this guy.
Yeah.
It makes sense that it was for charity because it was such like it's a very lighthearted kind of horror comedy thing, but they have so many names in it. It's really impressive, but it makes sense. It was for charity. And yeah.
I mean, All I know is what I was told. So
that's really funny.
One of the things my agents, he called me, he said, did you work? Did you make money on that? And I said, no, I did it for charity, because he told me it was for cat spaying. And my agent went,
oh, no.
Like, what an idiot, you know, because he wasn't my agent at the time when I did it. He was like disgusted with me.
Well, obviously in 2020, you know, the whole world was shut down, so horror conventions were not an option. But when you do a horror convention, what do people talk to you most about? Like Chopping Mall or Night of the Comet? Like, what is your experience?
It's really, you could never tell. Sometimes it's all about Night of the Comet and they're like, what's Chopping Mall? And then really? I remember you on the soap. What are this?
Because soap fans are so dedicated. They follow you everywhere.
Right. So I'm Kimberly to them. They don't know Samantha or Alice. And they go, what are all these other things you're in? And I said, they're horror movies. And they go, oh, so when you were working with Seneca, so they just want to hear about the soap. And they don't know. And then horror fans have no idea, for the most part, that I was ever on a soap. That's news to them.
Right.
So it's two distinct. So sometimes it's Chopping Mall. And then every once in a while, I never expect this, it'll be the Zero Boys will get some heat.
Oh.
Like, how do you even, because most of the time it's like, what's this? You know, because it's kind of an underground thing.
Yeah.
But lately, I mean, Hans Zimmer did, it was his first American.
Yeah, the score is like, boom.
And I want to check out Slayground now. How can I get, I really want to see that, because now it's, I know it came first here.
It's on DVD, but it's a cassette, but it's not, I mean, not, it's on VHS cassette, but it's not a DVD.
Oh, yeah.
It's not streaming.
Yeah, it's not streaming. Yeah. I just open
the movies that I introduce. I paved the way for Peter Coyote to be the real killer. Uh-huh. And there was talk for a little bit about, because his boots, you can see his boots when he's going to go kill somebody. They show his feet. So I had little tiny cowboy boots and they showed my feet. So they thought it might be funny if at the end, the little bitty cowboy boots are coming to get Peter Coyote. But they went back to London. I'm sure they forgot all about it. So I just opened the movie, because the reason that the getaway car does not show up is because I killed a guy.
Their
getaway car never shows up, and then that's why the movie starts.
So right now, what are you up to now? Because I know you have your own production company, Badass Cheerleader Productions, which is awesome. Yes. And I know on IMDb it says that you have a few projects going mm-hmm. on. But how was Badass Cheerleader Productions formed?
I was thinking of a name, and my friend is a numerologist, and I said, you know, I just because sometimes I feel like, you know, you don't have to trot that out every time I'm around, you know, because I do want people to know who I am now, you know. And he said, this is the one. And I went, you know, it is the one. I get it. So it became, I surrendered. That's how people are going to know it. You know? And I realized too, as a person, you know, I am a cheerleader for other people. So it makes sense to me. I didn't see that at the time, but my dad was a football coach. I had nothing, no interest in football or anything, but.
Same here.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was shocked that people saw me as a cheerleader like twice. But now I get it.
Yeah. No, I mean, and I love that you said that, because it is so much more than just on the surface being a cheerleader. It's like, you know, you're an icon and inspiration for people like us who are huge fans of the genre, and just being such a great presence in it and really loving what you do and loving the fans. That's what we love, because, you know, we have grown up on these movies. We love this genre, and seeing people like you embrace it really means a lot to us.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Of course I do. I feel really, really lucky. And, you know, grateful. And people tell me stories about, you know, how it showed up in their lives. Mm-hmm. And it's very touching. I mean, the whole point of being an actor is to connect with people. Mm-hmm. And so that's the whole point of my life, is doing that. So mm-hmm. when I hear that it was successful, because you make it and it goes out into the ethers and you're not sure what happened after that. And then as actors, you go on and do something else and you forget about it because you have to. You have to. I don't want you to feel bad, you know, because if there was ever a Night of the Comet, Kathy and I would be there mm-hmm. in a hot second. You know that. I just want
definitely.
Of course.
I didn't want to make it sound like, oh, that's never, you know, because we would totally be there.
Yeah. And we wouldn't want it any other way. So we have one final question for you. And we asked this to all of our interviewees at the very end. What is one thing that you can tell us about your experience, either working on Night of the Comet or Chopping Mall, that you've never told any other interviewer or publication or podcaster or convention? One thing that you've never told anyone else? It can be something that happened behind the scenes, an Easter egg, but just as long as you've never told anyone else.
Okay. Let me think for a second.
Okay.
I know we're putting her on the spot.
You know what? Because it was nighttime and most of us were not, you know, my sleep is permanently screwed up now from doing all these night shoots. All these years later, I was always kind of a night owl, but it's really bad. So when Worski, I guess, would put, his advice was to put tinfoil on your windows. It sounds like a serial killer, but that's what they do. The directors, and so the light doesn't come in. But you know, everybody was tired and everything. So Tony and I would just curl up on the floor like little hamsters. And I'm sure it looked really weird.
In the mall or
where? Yeah, we were in the mall. I remember we were in the furniture store and we just curled up together like little hamsters.
Oh.
And Winorski hated that. And so I don't know why, I guess. But anyway, so that's one thing I don't think I've ever.
That's great. That's a good one.
I love it. I love that the director minded, even though isn't that more bonding between you guys? That sounds like, yeah, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I just, that's another thing. We didn't really talk about anything other than, you know, when we were at work. But for some reason, people really like that relationship a lot. It's like, it's not really about the robots. It's kind of a survivalist love story.
Yeah.
It is. And also your relationship, it's the most with Ferdy, it's the most innocent, but it's like, you know, every other couple is literally just having sex, like in the mall. And you guys, like, there's an actual, you know, connection between them. And then you guys end up surviving. So it all works out.
But we didn't have sex. That's why we survived.
Exactly.
Oh, yes, not the classic horror thing. But, you know, one time somebody said to me about the people being right behind, like, it looks like they're not even 6 feet behind us. And that was when we shot our scene, they weren't there. Right.
Right.
But I thought, you know what? That is so true. They're back there making all sorts of sex. And we're not even like, I mean, other than saying, reacting to the sound once, we don't really deal with it. I'm not sure we would actually still be sitting there.
No, it's very funny because like all the couples are so close to each other and I'm like, would that happen? That's a little weird.
I'm not sure because they were all shot separately. So we had this reunion when Jim and Steve Mitchell, who co-wrote the script, they did the Blu-ray themselves. It was a labor of love. Nobody said, oh, we're going to send it to, you know, have this big swell Blu-ray. They did that themselves. And so when it came out, it really looks good. We had a thing at the Egyptian Theater and everybody was
there. I was there.
You were there. Oh, mm-hmm. Oh, so yeah, that's the first time I'd seen some of those people since, you know, like, so it was really something. We were all kind of, it's a weird thing how you can do some little horror movie and it just makes you feel good every time you see the people again. That's an odd thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And we love, as fans love to hear that because, you know, we see these characters that we love and like to know that they either still keep in touch or are, you know, still feel those bonds later. So mm-hmm.
here, you know? Yeah, well, we do. And Barbara and I were in the first trailer for 1984 Superwoman 1984.
Oh.
They show stuff that didn't end up in the movie. Like he appears in a members only jacket at the mall. He's like, what am I wearing? They show Barbara and I, and we run up to the counter, and then they cut, like, just in time to not have to pay us for the footage. Also, you know, we're part of the Marvel Universe now, because a show, they had one of the characters that was a Chopping Mall fanatic, and he was always talking about Chopping Mall.
Oh.
And they had it on TV at least once.
Wow, I never knew that.
Well, it's a thing. Awesome.
Yeah, that's a good tidbit.
Yeah, we're just getting tidbit after tidbit now. It's all coming out. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's when you're trying to come up with something, I just kind of think maybe this stuff is oozing from my pores. But when you ask the question, I go blank. But I guess I can't really exist without having this stuff ooze from my pores.
No, you did a great job.
Oh, this is great. Well, look, we are so, like I said, we are so grateful that you took the time to be on our podcast. Yes. We're such big fans. It was just so nice talking with you. So
it's my pleasure. I love you guys. So just keep me posted. If there's ever anything you need, let me know.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you so much. It really means a lot. Thank you, Kelly. Okay, bye. Bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Happy Horror Time. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, and through our website, happyhorrortime.com.
If you haven't already, please like and follow Happy Horror Time page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Happy Horror Time.
We love hearing from our listeners, so if you want to contact us, send us an email at happyhorrortime@gmail.com. You can tell us what you like about the podcast, give us movie recommendations, interview suggestions, or dating advice for Tim.
Oh, Matt. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit patreon.com/happyhorrortime to sign up. Patrons get access to our growing library of bonus episodes where we look back at old horror films, popular franchises, and other fun stuff.
I'm Matt Emmert.
And I'm Tim Murdoch.
And we hope you've had a happy horror time.